I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, reports of airstrikes and casualties at an Algerian complex. More than 100 people reported killed in homes. Syria is to receive more international food aid.
The government has given us their consent to go into every area. The challenge is we have seen more attacks on our trucks.
And helping Afghan women gain computer literacy and language skills. It's all ahead. Algerian forces have raided a remote desert gas plant where Al-Qaeda-linked militants seized hostages Wednesday. A spokesman for the militants was quoted as saying 34 hostages and 15 of their captors were killed in the operation. Details on the situation remain sketchy. The Mauritanian news agency ANI said it received word on the casualties today from one of the militias at the complex located east-central Algeria. The news agency reports Algerian helicopters attacked as the militants were trying to leave the complex with at least some of their captives. The unidentified militant told the news agency at least 7 Western hostages were still alive. Separately, Algeria's news agency, citing local sources, says the military has freed 4 foreigners. Initial reports, the captives freed was a Kenyan, a French national, and 2 from the United Kingdom. Al-Qaeda-linked Islamist militants said they kidnapped as many as 41 foreigners at the complex on Wednesday in what the militants call retaliation for French military action in neighboring Mali. The gas complex is operated in part by British energy firm BP. In a statement, BP said it was evacuating some of its non-essential workers out of Algeria. Today's events in the nation have focused attention to a key player in North Africa. Richard Cochrane is the Middle East and North African analyst at IHS Jane's, a leader in defense and intelligence analysis. From London, he spoke with VOA's Joe DeCapua about Algeria's importance to stability in Africa's Sahel region.
Algeria is pretty crucial to the stability of the region. It's the major military power, and it's one of the U.S.'s most staunch sort of allies in the war against terror. So its position in the region is sort of a crucial crux. Algeria also has extensive experience of counter-terrorist operations, and it knows the groups that are operating in the Sahel because many of the jihadis fighting there are actually Algerian. So it has extensive experience in dealing with exactly the type of militants who attacked the gas facility yesterday.
Despite its success, it has a rather low profile when it comes to terrorism.
Algeria's got a very painful history of Islamist extremism and terrorism stemming from the civil war that erupted in the 90s that didn't really gather a lot of attention in the West but resulted in up to 200,000 people dead. In the years since that, from 2000 onwards, it's been sort of dealing with a steadily declining Islamist insurgency. This sort of squares in with the Algerian sort of policy of non-intervention. They've never been interested in sort of liaising with other powers to handle their problems. They've always been very focused on dealing with them in-house and themselves. So while this counterterrorism strategy has been ongoing for the last few years and it's had a lot of success at dampening down extremism in the country, it's also had the result of pushing many of these jihadi fighters south into the Sahel of northern Mali and Mauritania and northern Niger. In many ways, it's sort of displaced the problem beyond its own borders. And the trouble is now with sort of added regional instability coming out of the result of Libya and, of course, now Mali, that there's a very real danger, as we saw yesterday, that these jihadis are going to be pushed northwards by military intervention in Mali. So sort of the Algerian government's worst fears coming true, really.
Why has it been so successful in getting them out of the country?
The Algerian government, it's been quite clever in how it's handled the issue. After the forces of the state triumphed over the Islamist rebels during the civil war, they've sort of conducted a dual-pronged approach of really assertive counter-terrorist strategies involving the military and highly trained commando forces to root out terrorists from their sanctuaries, mainly in the east, and offers of amnesty as well. President Bouteflika has sort of spearheaded this amnesty and reconciliation drive, where he said if former terrorists renounce violence and hand themselves in, then they'll receive more lenient sentences. So this carrot-and-stick approach has proven dividends in the country itself. But of course, those hardcore fighters who don't want to get wiped out by the force of the state and don't want to surrender have had to find sanctuary elsewhere. And of course, that proved to be the Sahel, and that's sort of the nexus of this Islamist group, which came to be known as Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, sort of formed around. And now you've got all these Islamist factions that are affiliated with AQIM or under its umbrella operating in the region have been bolstered by the events of the last 2 years, and particularly the sort of flow of weapons and training out of Libya.
You use the term Algeria's worst nightmare. How so?
Algeria, as I say, has a painful memory of Islamist extremism, and for that to return in such a bold way is a real embarrassment to the government, especially as in recent months it's sort of been spearheading regional efforts to join together in border security pacts and make public pronouncements that militants aren't going to get across the frontiers. Now, of course, that's not realistic because of the lack of capacity, particularly in Libya, to keep these groups out. There's also the economic aspect, which is incredibly important. Algeria is overwhelmingly reliant on hydrocarbon for its economic well-being, and particularly gas. And this gas field that was attacked is a very significant contributor to its overall export percentage. So for militants to not only attack the field, but take hostages, and if these unfolding events are true, that the security forces have gone in such a robust way, dramatically elevate the risks for foreign investors in Algeria. You know, Algeria is well aware that these sites were targets, which is why guards and the army were on the station to respond to this event. And the sort of fact that they've been unable to defend these workers is going to be a cause of severe embarrassment, and perhaps longer-term problems for Algeria in persuading new investors to come to the country and work in these sort of isolated southern regions.
Does it mean that Algeria will now be pulled into what's happening in Mali?
It's a difficult question to answer. Algeria has always pursued this non-interventionist stance, and I think when they opened their airspace to French warplanes last week in response to the French intervention in Mali, which took many by surprise, it also took Algeria by surprise, and they were forced to make a decision one way or the other of which side to come down on. Algerian politicians have been quite equivocal in recent months as to how they would respond to the situation in Mali. They favored a negotiated solution while not ruling out the possibility of using their military. This now puts them in a very difficult position that these militants have proven themselves able to strike sort of the core of Algeria's economic interests. I would imagine there's some pretty passionate debates going on in Algeria right now as to whether to finally bite the bullet and send the military across the border into Mali. But it's a very difficult decision for Algeria to make, as they've been very wary of stirring up the hornet's nest, if you like, that France has now done. And while the militants have said that the act of opening their airspace to France is a declaration of war, it takes it to a whole different level if you send Algerian troops into the region. Algeria's primary focus has always been to keep these fighters out of the country and beyond its borders. I think they'll remain hesitant to risk opening, you know, Pandora's box and committing to a full-scale intervention. But we'll see what the fallout of today's events will be.
Richard Cochrane, Middle East and North Africa analyst at IHS Jane's in London. Syrian activists say forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad have killed more than 100 people in an attack on the central city of Homs. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said today the attack happened Tuesday, with pro-government forces burning homes and shooting victims. It said the 106 dead included women and children, and it urged the United Nations to investigate. The observatory gathers data from a network of activists, medics, and lawyers on the ground in Syria. Events in the country are difficult to confirm because the government severely restricts access for international journalists. The Syrian conflict has killed at least 60,000 people since it began in March of 2011. The World Food Program says the Syrian government has agreed to let the agency work with dozens of Syrian organizations to distribute food aid throughout the war-torn country. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The World Food Program currently provides food aid to 1.5 million needy people inside Syria. WFP Executive Director Ertharin Cousin says the agency has not been able to expand its operation because only the Syrian Arab Red Crescent has been authorized to distribute food. But last week, she says, the Syrian authorities gave the agency a list of 110 non-governmental organizations that can help distribute food. Out of this list, she says, WFP has chosen 44 groups with whom it will work. Cousin says this will enable WFP to scale up its operation to feed an additional 1 million people.
What we did not have in the past was permission from the government to formally develop relationships with additional NGO partners. We have now been given that additional authority from the government. We are still going to be limited by the ongoing conflict. Where there, I am not going to suggest that merely because we will now have more partners, that that will open up space that didn't exist before because of conflict.
Because of an escalation in the fighting, Cousins says the Syrian Arab Red Crescent was able to reach 900,000 people in December. With the addition of the new partnerships, she says WFP is nearly tripling its reach.
The government has given us their consent to go into every area. The challenge is we have seen more attacks on our trucks in the last 2 months. We have seen more attacks on our trucks from the opposition. But what we find is that we can actually talk to them, and most time we get our food back. But it makes it more difficult for our drivers to go into these areas.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Afghan women are often portrayed in miserable and bleak shades, forbidden from getting education or working outside their homes, hidden beneath their burqas, and forced to remain silent. The Afghan Women's Writing Project was founded 3 years ago to change that image. As Faiza El-Masri tells us in this report voiced by Faith Lapidus, the project uses an online center where Afghan women can gain computer literacy and language skills, and the courage to tell their own stories.
In the virtual space created by the Afghan Women's Writing Project, or AWWP, women have the freedom to write about whatever they want, and they can receive mentoring by a volunteer team of teachers and authors. Zahra A., who is in her 20s, is excited about telling her story through the project's website.
She's the daughter of uneducated farmers who place great value on education for their children in the face of community and extended family disapproval.
American novelist Naomi Benaron is Zahra's mentor.
She puts the despair right on the page, but she is eternally hopeful.
Zahra teaches English at an orphanage and writes about Afghan girls' life experiences and aspirations. Benaron reads from one of Zahra's poems, Daughter of War.
I will try. I will stand for my right. I will break the silence. I will show my power. And I will bring peace in my country once again. I promised. There will be no more war. I will make my dreams come true.
It is important to a certain kind of survival to tell your own story, to tell it out loud. When you tell your own story, you see it in different ways. Then you make changes that are right for you.
Masha Hamilton, an American journalist and novelist, founded the Afghan Women's Writing Project in 2009, 10 years after her first visit to Kabul. She was inspired, she says, by all the strong, smart Afghan women she encountered who are eager to learn and express themselves.
We don't teach English. They write in English to the best they can. We fix it up. We work with them on their creative storytelling abilities.
Over the past 3 years, the number of women taking part in the project has grown steadily as the women share their experiences with their friends and family. Journalist Susan Postlewaite edits their stories and poetry.
We have about 100 writers now, and we are adding more writers. Our oldest writer is 45, and our youngest writer is about 14.
These women often face enormous risks to write their stories. Postlewaite says some of them hide laptops under their burqas while walking through Taliban-controlled territory.
They do write in secret to some extent. Their families may not necessarily be supportive of them expressing their opinions to the world. We had one writer who did write in secret. She had to walk 4 hours to get to an internet. She was accompanied by a young male relative.
Recently, AWWP moved out of cyberspace into an actual building in the capital city, Kabul, where women can come, use the internet, and inspire one another.
I feel I'm not alone. There needs to be change.
20-year-old Manaz joined the group 3 years ago. In her poem, Legitimizing Inequality, she explores how women become victims of cultural and religious beliefs.
They use our body, then mock our beauty and call us weak. They use our fairness to sell our soul, to crush our dignity. There are individual men and women who hold tight to their ways by telling us we are unequal. This is how they enforce wrong cultural beliefs. They are wrong. We are not infidel. We are different but equal. We are women, strong in our faith and ability.
Manaz wants to continue writing and dreams of becoming a novelist. She says the Afghan Women's Writing Project opened the door for her and other writers to have a voice and be a force for change. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.